You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, who yet again, unfortunately, is doing this part of the series solo. But keep Sven in mind. Just because it happened a while ago, it shouldn't the intensity, the edge shouldn't anger shouldn't go away. I actually was going to do something on the BRICS enlargement. People have actually been asking me about that. If you go back to the archives of this show, a lot of the same points have been made repeatedly. But as I was preparing to do that, I came across an article by the editor of Center for Research on Globalization in Canada. Michel Trusadovsky. And it's really based on one sentence that the head of NATO said to the Washington Post. And that simple sentence is that the war began in 2014. And of course, he's referring to the war in Ukraine. And I've read it in context. We'll mention that here in a minute. He clearly didn't say it on purpose, but that very sentence, the public admission from what is essentially a CIA outlet in the Washington Post, that the war began in 2014, not last year, has tremendous implications. The most obvious is that NATO can't claim anymore that the special military operation, as the Russians call it, on the 24th of February, 2022, they can't say that that constitutes an invasion. Now, I'm not big on international law because it has no enforcement mechanism. The most you could say about international law is that it can be used to justify something that would have happened anyway. There is no law where there can't be any enforcement. There are no courts. You know, The Hague is not a court. It's NATO's semi-judicial arm. So, nevertheless, at least as far as rhetoric is concerned, the implications of this statement are tremendous. He's speaking on behalf of NATO, and he said that Russia did not declare war on Ukraine back when this started. And that's when he says the war started in 2014. And of course, there's one other place where you've heard that, and that's me, of course. 2004 was the first so-called Orange Revolution. Euromaidan was much more thoroughgoing 10 years later. But let me quote him directly. Actually, Lee Hukstadter, who's on the Washington Post editorial board. His question is, how has the war led NATO to recalibrate its defense posture and doctrine? And Jan Stoltenberg says this: the war in Ukraine has fundamentally changed NATO, but then you have to remember the war didn't start in 2022. The war started in 2014. And since then, NATO has implemented the biggest reinforcement of our collective defense since the end of the Cold War. For the first time in our history, we have combat-ready troops in the eastern part of the alliance, the battle groups in Poland, Lithuania, the Baltic countries, actually the whole 8 battle groups from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, and higher readiness of our forces, increased defense spending. That last part is not a sentence, but that's what he said. And that's the context of his statement. And of course, he's right. But what happened in 2014? He goes on to fully admit that the point of the Western finance riots in 2004, early 2014, was to eventually integrate Kyiv as a full member of NATO. Let me quote from that same interview again. The Post asks, what does a plausible way forward to Ukraine's eventual membership in NATO look like? And he responds, first of all NATO allies agree that Ukraine will become a member of the alliance. All allies agree that Ukraine has a right to choose its own path, and that is not for Moscow, but for Kyiv to decide. Now, given what he said above, he is well aware that he's being disingenuous here. As I've said for many years, that Ukraine, at least since 2004, is not an independent country by any normal sense of the term. It is at best a protectorate of the U.S. and NATO, sharing some kind of power. And the proof of that is pretty substantial. So the war has been going since 2014. You can't say the Russian operation is an invasion, because they, you know, when this first happened, they invoked Article 2, Section 4 of the UN Charter. And it says that members of the United Nations shall refrain from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. Now, what happened in 2014, as I wrote about ad nauseum, was that Western finance riots in the early part of that year overthrew President Yanukovych and installed Yushchenko, the former head of the central bank, which shouldn't surprise anybody. Now, with this admission, in other words, the West started this, they can't use that article anymore, because in fact, it applies both to Kyiv as well as U.S. and NATO. Because clearly, Western intelligence was behind the 2004. It's not a coup, really. It was a revolution, but it only took place in Kyiv, which is quite suspicious that it was only in one city that happened. Now, that same year, Kyiv, being openly, explicitly supported by U.S. NATO, were engaged in coordination, because that colonial administration that was imposed on Kyiv had initiated what amounted to a de facto state of war against the Donbas, or Novorossiya, Luhansk, and Donetsk. So using the rhetoric of international law, you can't say that this is an act of war against Russia, led by the U.S. In truth, it was an act of war against Ukraine and the people of Ukraine. And Putin himself, he defined this SMO, Special Military Operation, as a way to support the republics Donetsk and Luhansk. And the stated objective was to demilitarize Ukraine. And, you know, he also, you know, the nonsense about this being a neo-Nazi government, this is something that Chosudovsky mentions a lot. In fact, it was so irritating that I've eliminated it in my rendition of this. While it's true there was a substantial National Socialist movement there, they certainly had nothing to do with 2014. There's no way they would be fighting for a government like this if they were truly that way. For Putin, when he says denazify, the only thing that makes any sense there, given the eccentric definitions of these things in the East, is to remove politicians that were installed, many of them not Ukrainian, citizens of other countries, in power after 2014. And given the clampdown on the media since then, almost really since 2004, but definitely since 2014, there hasn't been an honest election, and certainly not since 2014, because a huge portion of the eastern part of the country was no longer a part of it. But as the media was purged of anything pro-Russian, there is no legitimacy to any of that system there. But then, you know, he also cites the UN Charter, and he says, and it says, I should say, nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the UN. That means, of course, that the SMO complies fully with the requirements of self-defense. And in that same speech, it's actually February 24th of 22, the day the war began, and he referred to the fundamental threats which irresponsible Western politicians created for Russia consistently, rudely, and unceremoniously from year to year. I'm referring to the eastern expansion of NATO, which is moving its military infrastructure ever closer to the Russian border. Now, that's easy enough to show. There's plenty of maps showing where American and NATO military bases are, and they're structured where they're surrounding both Russia and China. So, the Ukraine war, if it began then, not in 2022, but 2014, this was a U.S.-NATO initiative. The war that began on the eastern states, or the eastern republics, also began that year. The regime that the U.S. installed in Kiev then engaged in constant hot warfare with the East. Now, at that time, the militias from Novorossiya won. They had defeated the Ukrainian army, many of whom refused to fight anyway. And that's the specific issue that drove the rebuilding of the Ukrainian military. But the revolution of 2014, some people call it, you know, Euromaidan, the New York Times said is a flowering of democracy, a blow to authoritarianism and kleptocracy in the former Soviet space. And that article came out on March 1st of 2014. I know I've cited it a few places before. And it's hard to tell if this is nothing more than propaganda, and the author is well aware it's simply not true, or ignorance is such that they could say something like this with a straight face. The article was, after initial triumph, Ukraine's leaders face battle for credibility. Now, the truth that I said way back then was that US-NATO engineered, through a carefully staged covert operation, the formation of a proxy regime integrated within Kiev, conducive to the removal and brutal demise of the president who was elected, Yanukovych. That was initiated actually in late 2013, and the claim is that the street protests were led by the right sector, especially Dmytro Yurosh, who I've spoken about before, creating the paramilitary elements of that. Now, these groups, whether it be Svoboda or Right Sector or Azov, in any election, local and national, that they were ever engaged in, they receive single digits. They have ties with the Israeli military, as I've said, you know, a while ago. I don't remember if it was Yurosh or Barubi or whoever, but they're not what they say they are, because no actual National Socialist would ever fight for this government in Kiev. That doesn't make any sense. The most you can say is that nationalist movements were co-opted really for the sake of discipline and to beef up the military. And of course, Yurosh demanded the disbanding of the Party of Regions, which is exactly what happened, and that was Yanukovych's party. I also said at the time that, if you recall the story that snipers were picking off protesters, and the American press, who was very tightly controlled, especially in this case at the time, led by the Washington Post, said that this was a way, an actual bizarre way, that Yanukovych was trying to break up the protests, which, of course, could never work. That doesn't make any sense, and he had absolutely nothing to gain by doing something so stupid. No, in fact, it was Yarosh, his group, as well as Parubi of the Sabota Party. And there was a leaked telephone conversation between the foreign minister of Estonia, Urmas Paet, and the European commissioner, or the Union commissioner, Catherine Ashton, which confirmed that, quote, the snipers who shot at protesters and police in Kiev were hired by Ukrainian opposition leaders. And this is Paet talking to Catherine Ashton. And this is what she says. This is March of 2014. The foreign minister says, there is now stronger and stronger understanding that behind the snipers, it was not Yanukovych, but it was someone from the new coalition, that is, Parubi and Yarosh. And second, what is quite disturbing, this same Olga Bogomolets told as well that all the evidence shows the people who were killed by snipers from both sides, among policemen and people from the streets, that they were the same snipers killing people on both sides. And she's quoting a doctor here. She also showed me some photos and said that as a medical doctor, she can say that it's the same handwriting, the same type of bullets, and it's really disturbing. Now, the new coalition, they don't want to investigate what exactly happened. And that was corroborated in March, or a bit earlier, March 13th, 2014. And the Kiev Post, of course, is owned by the Washington Post. And let me quote this one, too. This is March 13th, 2014. Former state security head of Ukraine, Alexander Yakimenko, blames Ukraine's current government for hiring snipers on February 20th when dozens of people were killed and hundreds wounded. The victims were mainly Euromaidan revolution demonstrations, but some police officers were also killed. This was the deadliest day during the Euromaidan revolution, a three-month uprising that claimed 100 lives. Yakimenko also blamed the United States for organizing and financing the revolution by bringing illegal cash into the country using diplomatic mail. Yakimenko says that Parubi, who, again, the leader of the Svoboda Party, as well as a number of other organizers of Euromaidan, received direct orders from the U.S. government. These are the forces that were doing everything that were told by the leaders and representatives of the United States. They, in essence, lived in the U.S. embassy. There wasn't a day when they didn't visit that embassy. From the beginning of Maidan, we as a special service noticed a significant increase in diplomatic cargo to various embassies, Western embassies located in Ukraine. And that's a direct quote from Yakimenko. It was tens of times greater than usual diplomatic cargo supplies, and he says that right after such shipments as newly minted U.S. Currency was spotted on Maidan. Now, I don't read the Kiev Post, but I could have told you this, and I did tell you this anyway, at the time. And what we're supposed to, and this is in my book on Ukraine, by the way, simply called Ukrainian Nationalism, that here you have alleged national socialists fighting to ultimately install a government that is not independent and that will serve the interests of NATO and the EU. And they did not turn on that. They didn't reject them. They, in fact, serve them all the more vehemently now, even more so than back then. So you were supposed to believe that the street protests at the time, 2014, spontaneously developed to insert Ukraine into the European Union and, to a lesser extent, NATO. Well, first of all, if the nationalists were a part of that, then they wouldn't be a part of it. That's the exact opposite of what they're supposed to, be in favor of. And in my book on Ukrainian nationalism, I go into some detail as to what the ruling principles of some of these groups are, at least at their best. And that somehow the organizers of the street protests wanted, Ukraine had dissolved in the 1990s from the very same people that are promoting, that are being promoted in the European Union. No one in the East trusts capitalism, and certainly not Western capitalism. These countries were almost completely destroyed in the 1990s. Kuchma in Ukraine helped save it. at least temporarily. And of course, he was, Kuchma was Yanukovych's predecessor, who did have impressive economic numbers because he wasn't on board with the U.S. against Russia. Remember, there were sanctions even back then. So, allegedly, Parubi, which actually, and he, along with Ole Tanimbok, was the founder of the Social National Party of Ukraine, and they changed the name later on. And because Victoria Nuland and others were actually deciding who should serve in that cabinet, Parubi was first appointed Secretary of the National Security and National Defense Committee, which, by the way, is a key position, and it oversees the Ministry of Defense, the armed forces, law enforcement, national security, intelligence. Then from 2015 to 2019, he became vice chairman and chair, actually, of the Verkhovna Rada, or the high legislature, somehow shifting into the realm of international diplomacy on behalf of the regime. Now, there was nothing. I mean, nationalism at most was a cover that he used. I go into detail on how these organizations were initially founded, at least in the 1940s, if not before. And in the process, Parubi developed all kinds of contacts in North America and Europe, even the European Parliament. He was invited to Washington on several occasions. He met with the unlamented Senator John McCain in 2015 on the Senate Armed Services Committee. He was also invited to Ottawa and met up with the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, in 2016. So for anyone to claim this is somehow a National Socialist group of people is laughable. He was simply an agent of the Jewish oligarchs in Ukraine. Part of the purpose of me writing the book Ukrainian Nationalism is that there is a good case to be made. It doesn't have to be anti-Russian. And there's many. I mean, I even quote Nikolai Gogol, who made a case for a limited form of Ukrainian nationalism that doesn't have to be anti-Russian. You know, I use a bunch of examples, Belarus being only one. So Victoria Nuland, as I mentioned, did decide who served in the government in Kiev back then and who didn't. And she was acting as a emissary of the State Department, and the official term was suggesting key appointments. Tianibok was not granted a cabinet position, but Svoboda and Reitsichter were granted key positions in defense, national security, law enforcement. Not to mention, they also control the judicial process. The prosecutor general was given to Makhinsky, Oleg Makhinsky, of the Svoboda Party. And that was in February of 2014. Again, if these were National Socialists, they wouldn't be involved in this at all, let alone permitting themselves to be used by the likes of Victoria Nuland. But that is the most powerful proof you're ever going to get that the government in Kiev was a colonial administration, because Nuland was deciding who was there and who wasn't. And as I've mentioned many times in the past, it included people like Justice Vili from Georgia, who was actually still an arrest warrant out for him in his own country. He's been in this cabinet. People from the Baltics and even Central Europe have been installed by Nuland within this cabinet. So it wasn't exactly a matter of sovereignty. And anyone thinking critically at the time would know that. So for people like Josadovsky to go on and on about neo-Nazis, Josadovsky, by the way, was a supporter of Mao Zedong many years ago. I have his book on the topic. Now, that doesn't, you know, he has a checkered past, but him talking about neo-Nazism with that background is a little rich. But it's also true that NATO was involved in training the Azov Battalion since that very year, since 2014. The Kiev government has been generously funded by NATO itself. Now, the Azov Battalion was eventually integrated into Ukraine's National Guard, and that's under the jurisdiction of Ukraine's Ministry of Internal Affairs. But in 2015, they were trained by the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. Let me quote the Los Angeles Times here, April 20th, 2015. The U.S. contingent of instructors includes 290 specialists. Britain has dispatched 75 military personnel responsible for training in command procedures and tactical intelligence. So this has been going on for some time. Because the eastern regions had defeated Kiev in their civil war in 2014, the training program began, and the buildup of the military, which, of course, Ukraine can't afford. And, of course, at the same time, you had a huge influx of military equipment, which they called non-lethal military aid, which was a lie. So, in turn, the Azov Battalion has also been involved in the conduct of summer training camps for children and adolescents. The Sunday Times in Britain confirms that children and adolescents are eventually slated to be recruited in the National Guard. As I said, integrated into the Ukrainian military in 2016. Now, I mention all this stuff because it proves what I've said since then, that the war did start in 2014. One of the things that Putin and his supporters had pointed out was the Ukrainian artillery barrage against the Donbas. That was a proximate cause of the invasion. Because all told, from 2014, or actually say 2015, to the beginning of the war, there were 14,000 civilian deaths, and included children. The U.S. and NATO were supportive of this, and in fact supplied them not only with the equipment, but with the intelligence and all the electronics necessary here. And this is exactly what he means when he says the war actually started in 2014. Josadovsky also cites part of the four basic principles of the Law of Armed Conflict, LOAC. In the Additional Protocol 1, Article 48, it says, it consists in the respect for protection of civilian population and civilian objects. The parties to the conflict shall at all times distinguish between the civilian population and combatants and between civilian objects and military objectives, and accordingly shall direct their operations only against military objectives. So, you know, the truth is that civilian populations, you know, schools, hospitals, or residential areas, were the deliberate target of the Azov Battalion and some of these militias. The rules of war are taken a bit more seriously than international law, except, of course, in Ukraine. I've said 100 times that the accusation of war crimes against Russia is a matter of projection. Because they knew the exact opposite is true. Moscow made the decision as early as, you know, 2014 to come to rescue the Donbas. And so you have people like Peter Hofmansky of the ICC, the so-called criminal court, which is not a court, accused him of kidnapping Ukrainian children. Was a matter of projection, since Azov had children's camps. Some of them are of fighting age today, since this is a few years ago. Therefore, the actions of the Azov Battalion, which were aimed at civilian structures, remember, these are all Russian areas in the east, so they really don't care. The only reason Ukraine wants these places back is to destroy or neutralize a civilian population there. Whatever Azov and those groups do, the U.S. NATO bears the responsibility for it. So this wasn't just a matter of a rogue organization. This was a matter of policy. Now, Article 5 of the Atlantic Treaty, the so-called collective self-defense in NATO, is a simple thing. It just says the parties agree that an armed attack against one or more of them, members, in Europe or North America shall be considered an attack against them all. Now, Article 5 was invoked, some of you may remember, in March 1999, which was a completely fabricated idea, against Yugoslavia. It was then also invoked on September 12th, 2001, by the Atlantic Council in Brussels. to declare war on Afghanistan, who, of course, had nothing to do with anything that happened the previous day. And the grounds was that an unnamed foreign power attacked America September 11th, 2001. Either way, in both cases, Article 5 was fraudulently invoked. And Stoltenberg actually admits, and this has to be deliberate at his point, acknowledges that, quote, Russia is not seeking a full-fledged confrontation with NATO triggering Article 5. However, he does hint that NATO is prepared to invoke it against Russia, again, based on a fabricated pretext. And this is from the same interview I cited in the beginning. Washington Post asks, would a Russian attack on critical infrastructure like undersea cables owned by NATO members or companies cause the invocation of NATO's Article 5? Stoltenberg, being the chief of NATO, has an odd response. He said that's for NATO to decide. He says we are now looking into how we can do more when it comes to sharing intelligence, including with the private sector, to detect any potential threats. We've seen over the last year that Russia is not seeking a full-fledged confrontation with NATO, triggering Article 5, but they are trying to operate below the Article 5 threshold, meaning with hybrid, cyber, and covert actions. And of course, attacks against undersea infrastructure is easy to deny because it's hard to monitor. Now, that comment seems to hint that Russia was destroying its own pipeline, Nord Stream, in September of last year. The truth is, we all know that was ordered by President Biden. Biden is president of nothing. That administration, with the full acceptance of Olaf Scholz, Chancellor of Germany. So what he seems to say in that quotation is that the invocation of Article 5, as well as the use of some pretext to wage war on Russia, are being discussed behind closed doors. Stoltenberg also says that NATO is committed to supporting the Kiev regime while, quote, preventing escalation through increased military presence, as well as confirming that we are not a part of the conflict. Of course, he's being dishonest, as he always is. And he says the following. NATO has fundamentally two tasks in the war. One is to support Ukraine, as we do. The other is to prevent escalation. And we prevent escalation by making absolutely clear that we are not a party to the conflict and by increasing military pressure in the eastern part of the alliance, as we've done, with 40,000 troops under NATO command backed by substantial naval and air forces. Now, Trzaskowski says, and I agree, that preventing escalation can never be the case if there's any contemplation of invoking Article 5. You know, the last few years, there have been members of NATO, these corrupt politicians supporting the Ukraine war, and they have been the victims of U.S.-sponsored acts of economic terrorism, including the sabotage of the Nord Stream. We know what's happening in Germany with the mass bankruptcies, and that's spilling over everywhere. As I've said many times in the past, Germany was heavily invested in Russia. The EU economy always relied on cheap energy from Russia, and that's completely broken down. And you see disruptions in the entire structure of industrial production, transportation, commodities, especially Germany, Italy, and France. So you have corrupt politicians who were willing to sell out their own economy to destroy it just to remain in NATO's good graces. You're dealing with a situation of total instability, which they then project onto Russia. Germany's chancellor was fully aware that this sabotage had been contemplated and envisaged by the U.S. to the detriment of Europe. Now I'm going to quote him. A string of corporate bankruptcies resulting in layoffs and unemployment is unfolding across the European Union. Small and medium-sized enterprises are slated to be wiped off the map. Rocketing energy costs are savaging German industry. German's manufacturing industry, which accounts for more than a fifth of the country's economic output, is worried some of its companies won't see the crisis through. Industry behemoths like Volkswagen and Siemens are grappling with supply chain bottlenecks too, but it is Germany's roughly 200,000 small and medium-sized manufacturers who are less able to withstand the shock of rising energy prices. This apparently is the price of Ukrainian totalitarianism. Ukraine is a one-party state, as I've said before, is being built into another Israel by the U.S., with New Khazaria as a foundation. That, of course, is what the West means by democracy. But as I mentioned, many NATO member states are not going along with this. They become de facto enemies of the U.S. They become victims of this economic warfare. So that's Stoltenberg's latest, I don't know if it was a gaffe or what, but that admission completely destroys, just in one fell swoop, the entire narrative of the West concerning the war in Ukraine. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.